Session number 16711, Fred Welsh, Reel 10.
Mr. Welsh, Reel 10. You've just moved into the Gazala books, Mr. Welsh. What happened next?
Well, we were forever getting reinforcements, and in Reel 9 I mentioned a private, John Wise, a friend. And one of the replacements was a Tom Porter, private Tom Porter, who also came from Darlington. And within 2 days, we had the same rapport as I had with John Wise years ago. And to this day, Tom Porter and I are good friends, as is Mr. Wise. In fact, I was best man for Tom Porter after the war, the wedding. And Tom Porter, I say, would suffer as much as anybody in the 8th Army up the desert, because he wasn't ginger, he was red. And poor lad, he just used to burn red and the skin pale off and then start again, and he was forever in agony. And he joined us from hospital with, he'd had yellow jaundice, and he was from the 1st Battalion, but the 1st Battalion had gone to crease. So he was sent up and reinforced us, and as I say, was put in my section, because by now I'd received my first stripe, my only stripe. I wasn't keen to have a strike, but Major Jackson said he was in charge of the company, and he said who was NCOs and who weren't, and he said I was, from this day forth, a Lance Corporal. And in those days, you didn't answer back.
Did your duties change as Lance Corporal?
Well, the battalion were now in the midst of a big change. Because up the desert, it worked out if we had a 2-inch gun, Germans had a 4-inch. And it worked on and up till we got to open sights with 25-pounders, and they had 88s. So we were in the midst of changing into 6-inch mortar crews, and they were changing the personnel around a lot, splitting the companies up. And in this period, I was sent back towards Brigade HQ to go on a course to learn about a new weapon that was coming up, which was supposed to be a spigot mortar, a different kind of gun altogether, and I had to go to learn all about it. But before the course finished, the flap came, and nothing ever came of the spigot mortars. I went on this course, which was going to last a fortnight, but in the middle of it, we just got orders, make your own way back to your own lines as quickly as you could, because Rommel was in attack. The word used was as a flap on. And I went forward, I went find my own company, and I was the only one going forward. I think everybody else was going back. Everybody but the front line had got orders to retreat. But the 50th Div's orders were, do not move, fight out, get in, harass the Germans as much as you could, and give the tanks and the artillery time to get back to form a new line.
Before we come to that particular event, can we deal a little bit more with the box and life in the box itself? We've mentioned water and flies and heat, and the holes that you dug and lived in. The food itself, what was it like?
Well, it was under conditions, it was quite good. It was mostly corned beef. And you sometimes, in you were in such a position, you got the corned beef in a tin with biscuits. You hadn't, the cook hadn't time or a chance to cook it at all. But if you got a breakfast in the morning, which is bread, sausage or a bit of bacon or something, that would suffice, because the problem of wanting a drink lasted all day, and you would never, you couldn't face a salty meal to think, right, tonight I'll be thirsty again, because you went down and got your, you had a lunch, then you got your main meal at night, and that's when you fill your water bottles up, and you allowed a mouthful, that's all. And you never drank that water without an order. It was an offence to drink water without permission.
So that your officer would come to you and say, right, you're going to have a drink of water now?
Yes,
that was the procedure.
Time to have water, yes. Our officer then was, to me, a nice gentleman, Lieutenant Johnson. He came from Whitley Bay. A nice gentleman he was, and odd time the naffy came up and you could buy tins of fruit if you were lucky, if you got there. But the naffy trucks never came very far forward, so when you were out on point, you missed the naffy wagon being up, and you depended on your mate who was left back, your pal, who'd buy something for you if he had enough money for two lots. And you could buy toothpaste, you could buy cigarettes, you could buy sweets. And as I said, there was this special tin of fruit sweets, that boiled sweets that you sucked. But nothing appeased your thirst, nothing.
Did you get a payday every week?
No, I never got much pay, no, it wasn't much pay. Talking of drinking, I remember one occasion... And it was when we got back. It had been 114 degrees. And word came in that there was an unknown party at the other end of the minefield. Could they send up a patrol to see what it was? And the officer said he wouldn't send a patrol, you'd send a lance corporal and a private. Well, the lance corporal turned out to be me and Porter. And as I say, Porter struggled in the desert. And it nearly got me, it was really hot, it was like walking in an oven that midday. I mean, both armies rested during the day when there wasn't a battle on. There was nothing went on between 12 and 4. No patrols anyway. You just couldn't do anything. But we went out on this patrol, Porter and I. And when we got there, it turned out to be an armoured car of the South African division who was out of position. Shouldn't have been there. So we went up to them and said what had happened, and they corrected themselves and went back to their own sector. But on the way back, Porter took ill with his jaundice again. The outcome was I carried his kit back. It was only a mile. I carried his kit back and he struggled as best he could. And I took him straight to the sick bay. And the medical officer said he was completely dehydrated. He must have a pint of tea. Oh, this was like a bottle of champagne, a pint of tea for one man. And he was laid on the bed nearly as yellow as a daffodil. And he gulped this tea down. And I also remember he stopped and gave the pot to me, and the officer said, no, you must drink it all. He says, I'm sorry, sir, Corporal Welsh wants as much as I do. And I got a mouthful. And that was how you lived your life. And later on, we kept each other alive, there's no doubt about it. Kept our sanity. Porter and I were very, we were like brothers in the end. And he didn't get back to hospital, like he just stopped in the sick bay and was back within us in a couple of days.
You mentioned Nathy coming up. Did anyone else come up? Did Salvation Army get towards
no,
you?
No, no, no. You were very fortunate if you saw Nathy. There was always a man and the men, there wasn't women. And they were always, strangely enough, old soldiers who knew what you wanted. And they would come through the lines and... used to come up with the convoys at night, Nathy Foot and that, and go back. Always welcome sight.
You mentioned that you only had a little water which you had to wash with as well as drink and so on. Did you ever get the opportunity for the bath to arrive, mobile bath to come?
Oh, no. No, I never had a bath. No. No, you used to... What you washed in, I say we've got a bottle of water, but in reality we've got two bottles of water between two, which you shared. When I mean shared was, to get washed, you took the webbing outside of your tin hat, your helmet, put the screw back on without the webbing and put your water in there, and two of you got washed. In that. So you were never scrupulously clean. You just used to hang your shirts out in the wind to try and clean them. And, I mean, they hadn't a chance. You couldn't get stuff like that up. As I say, in this time, in 1942, transport belonged to the service corps. There was the CO didn't have his own truck, and the corporal had his own truck, and there wasn't a lot of trucks to spare. The double up, if the CO came up to see you, he would also bring the medical officer in one journey, and he would see if there was any sick. The main sick was desert sores, which with the dirt you. Places like your elbow used to break out when you were nailing on the sand, and your knees got these desert sores, and some got ulcers in the ankles, and you could never heal them because, I suppose now, it was the food. You didn't get the variety of food. You were plenty to eat, but as I say, biscuits and bully, and you tried everything. One delicacy we thought about was, we learnt to do, was a thing called biscuit burgoo. Where the name come from, I don't know. But you broke up as many biscuits as you had, because nobody could bite these biscuits that you got in the army. They were like doorsteps. And you boiled them, and you put as much Nestle's milk as you could find and buy, and that was the only sweet thing you got. And that was another thing. And we used to do patrols. And occasionally you did a company patrol, which was artillery, everything went forward to harass, to find our positions, put markers down for Royal Artillery, who was here, which regiment was there. And this would go out for a few days. And the CO, or the man in charge of this patrol, always rode at the front. And he sat on a big seat on like a ladder up a height so that he could give hand signals to people behind. And about a quarter to 12, you had the second driver, always two of the service going through. He was on his mark. When the CO made the stop sign, they were out, and there'd be 120 wagons in this. And within a minute, Every one of those workers had a fire going, making tea. And the fires were made out of petrol tins. Before we got jerrycans, we stole and learned that jerrycans were a good item to have. We had silver-coloured square tins which held about 3 gallons of petrol. When they were empty of petrol, they were cut in two and kept as coking. And you used to fill them with sand, pour petrol over them, chuck a match in them, and that was your cook. And within a minute, within 5 minutes, everybody was having the break. Each cook looked after themselves. And it always amazed me at the speed at which these wagon drivers could get out, find this tin of sand, get the petrol on it, set it on fire, and have the Dixies on boiling the tea. Of course, they were in the know, the service guys. They had barrels of water stuck in corners of the trucks, and they had extra rations. And they did well, but you always got a cup of tea on them, like, you know, you were allowed your pot of tea, but what was amazed me to see all these wagons at night, but you couldn't do it after tea, you were in the dark, it was just a cold ration when you were on a big patrol like that.
Can we talk about patrols now that you've mentioned them? The smaller ones first, were you ever on any of the smaller patrols?
Well, we used to do section patrols. A corporal would go out. And
were you briefed as to what you had to do, where you had to go?
Well, mainly you walked through your minefield, which was about just wide enough to get a wagon through. You knew that. And you had to walk on them. You couldn't walk anywhere else because of mine. And you would walk to the end and then maybe turn right or left, whichever your instructions were, and walked out to your mate. Maybe somebody from the 6th Battalion on, I think was on our left, or the South Africans who were on our right, and then you came back, and you had to do this. This went on every night. And
what type of patrols did you have? There were various types, weren't there? Reconnaissance patrol, fighting patrol.
The hardest ones were identity. I'll call them identity patrols. You went out and you tried to find what was on a wagon, what markings were on. Like Rommel's Africa Corps, their wagons had two palm trees on. As for instance, my own company had TT on in red and black. They had this fern on. You had to find whether were the Italians nearby or in the front, or were they behind the Germans. Where was the artillery? Where was the tanks? They were all to find out. And I always found this rather irritable, to be out in the middle of the night, because on your defences, for instance, you always put empty tins, tied them onto wire, put a pebble in. Now, to touch this in the black stillness of silence of night was like a church bell. The same way if you came across with you kicked an iron bar that had been left, the picket fence, or two pebbles kicked together. It used to sound like church bells to me, and I used to often wonder, is that guy asleep up there? I mean, we're talking, they were 200 yards away, you know, you were in firing range. You used to try and make marks, compass bearing the officer. If the officer went with you, you'd make a compass mark to take back to the artillery to say, right, they're there at such and such a point, and you would leave a mark, maybe put a few stones up, and the range finders could pick them out in the artillery. And these I always found very, very hard to seek out.
Do you recall any particular patrols that you were on?
Well, I remember coming back off one. There was just an officer, and I don't know whether I'm right or not, but I might have called this man Lieutenant Campion. I might be wrong there. But his main aim in life was to get the VC. And I didn't want the VC, foolishly. And we went out one night for an artillery marking job. That was to put some cairns up for this artillery that was causing us bother during the day, and we wanted to retaliate but couldn't get the range. And we went out, and this lad, in the middle of the night, he knocked two pickets, he knocked iron picket in with an iron picket, and made a good mark for the artillery to find it. But when we came back, we got our breakfast. He said, the problem with this front line is you're afraid of the name Rommel. He says, I think Rommel is a human being who would die if I shot him. He says, he's no myth to me, he's no legend to me, not yet. He says, I don't know anything about him. I don't want to know, he said, I'm here to fight him. And whether I'm right or wrong, he wanted to take a patrol and try and find and capture Rommel. He says, I don't. And it wasn't a out of the blue thing. He'd thought about it. And really, he was right. Rommel was a myth. The same as the Mark IV tank was a myth. All we used to see was the white tracks of the tanks were falling. You said, dear me, them's a bit bigger than Matilda's. What will they do to us? And but rather built up that these people were legends. Tanks were legends. And later in life, a certain Lieutenant Keyes, Colonel Keyes, Lieutenant Colonel Keyes, did get the VC for this attack. And I often wonder, was it from Lieutenant Campion's idea?
Was this prevalent amongst all of you, that Rommel was some exceptional being?
Yes, when this man pointed it out, I think it was. We've been out on patrol, and people stopped in their tracks when they seen the size of the tank traps, and that Rommel was building up an offensive. And it wasn't an army, it was Rommel. And as I say, all Rommel had, he was no better or no worse than anyone else, for all he's down in history. But he's lucky enough to have bigger than us. He had more tanks than us. He had bigger guns than us. He could move out of range. And it wasn't until, I never knew them all, I never met them, till Montgomery came and said, we're not running anymore, we're standing, we're going to fight this man. And that was the beginning to win. And as I say, really, when I mentioned the word flap earlier, it always was a flap. The rush to get away before you, to us, till you see if you could fight them where you stood. I never fought in the trench, I was forever on the move.
You mentioned the type of patrol that you went on. Did you have fighting patrols where you actually go and try and capture someone? Were you ever on any of those?
I was on one, a company patrol, when Malta was in problem. The convoys used to get bombed before they got into Malta. And it was thought that most of the planes used this Tamimi airstrip up the desert to bomb the convoys. So we decided, or was decided for us, that we would go, and it was also organised with the Navy would go through the same time as we attacked this airfield, not just to keep the planes grounded to try and get through, but it was a complete flop. We got lost, and we got beyond the airfield actually, and we had to come back out, but we got fastened down with artillery. And I also remember a certain Major Slade, another great person in our battalion, who put his tin hat on his shoulder helmets and put his DLI cap badge and his cap on straight as it should be, and walked among us with our sticks as we were laid shivering in this, "Come on boys, we're going home now." And he just walked us out of range. Thing I'll never forget. Great man.
What's it like under shellfire?
Very, very frightening. Very frightening. It's like an air raid. Because you can't do a thing about it. Artillery can fire back, but you can't fire back. And they're coming over all the time, 10 landing at a time all around her. And you know, you glance to the right and you see a Bren gun carrier stood and waiting of action. Next time you look, it's gone, completely gone. And the Stukas were the same. To be in among them and not be able to get out of range. And I mean, you couldn't run from them. It was no good. You had to take your chance. And as I say, we were brought up by Major Slide, because there was a few medals awarded for that. I think and somebody got an MM, somebody else got an EMC, and all that.
You didn't come into contact with the enemy, though, on that particular
corner. Oh yeah, we saw them there. We're fighting them there. Rifles there were near enough to use our rifles there, because you were well into his lines. You'd have got to, because to, it was easy to bypass anybody in the desert. You just had to ride a few miles into the desert, or then you could go around them. Sometimes you caught bad travelling, you know, for trucks you got into soft sand, but otherwise you could go around them. That's how Rommel did all his. He went round, he didn't attack. I mean, the first thing we knew of Rommel's attack was that we were surrounded, and that's when we started fighting in our own boxes, battalion boxes. And this was just, you had a whole box and you surrounded it, and you put wire around yourself and you stopped in there till, as I say, you took a chance. Harassment was the word used. You must harass the enemy, don't let them come directly through. But he was as far down, he was past Tobruk when we were fighting him.
When you were fighting him in this particular raid that you were on about, and you came within rifle range of each other, what are your feelings then? Did you get involved in the whole process? Or
why just get on with it?
Is there adrenaline flowing?
Well, it flows, and you use all of it up digging a hole. That's the only time you can dig a good hole, when that happens. And you get down, and the guy next to you will keep you going, you'll keep him going, and your machine guns are chattering away, so you're giving as good as you get.
Are you actually aiming at someone or aiming towards someone?
Towards them. You could never pick a... But I don't think I only ever shot. I can say I shot one, that's all one shot. But there was submachine guns, Bren guns, they had Spanders, you know, the Chessers had the Vickers going on fish lines, and you just carried on, you know. We lost a lot of men that day, and I think I was a lucky person in the whole war. They only ever got hit once. Nothing but...
Did you lose men in your section? I'm presuming your section was on that patrol.
No, I didn't. We didn't lose any. No, it was more to the right of me.
What are the feelings like at the end of an action and you're pulled out?
Well, absolute relief. First thing I wanted was toilet. You know. And as I say, I wasn't a coward, but I wasn't a brave man. I don't think I would have got medals if I'd still been there. And I only know one man who got the VC for constant heroics, and that was Flight Lieutenant Cheshire.